And the sutta we do today is the number one in the Majjhavidikaya. As I mentioned when we started, I left this at the very end because this is one of the really difficult ones. And it's fascinating why, when the monks would have been organized all of these teachings, these suttas, and why did they put this at number one in the beginning of the Majjhavidikaya? Now, a lot of people say, well, this Majjhavidikaya set of sutras, it matches, or it's similar to the sutras in the other great collections, especially in the Digha Nikaya. The very first sutra in the Digha Nikaya is the Brahmajala Sutra. And what is the Brahmajala Sutra all about? Wrong views. The 62 wrong views. That's just the way that would organize them. So you did that first of all to make sure that when you start these collection of teachings to get like an idea of what the Buddha said is right view. And here, this is similar, only much less easy to understand about what right view is. And there's a couple of other interesting parts of this sutta. Number one, it's very difficult to understand. And number two, of all the sutras in the whole collection of Tripitaka, this is the only one where the monks weren't delighted in what the Buddha said. Which is interesting. In order to expound this, what I'm going to do is to read it out. And when I'm reading it out, I'm not going to pause for questions. So no questions until after we're finished. Because after we've finished, I'm going to give you out some sheets of paper which summarise the sutta and which means you can find an explanation. But I want you to be just like this first group of monks. So hopefully, you too won't be delighted. So here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ samma dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So this is the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. The Mula means the root, and the Pariyaya just means the method of going to the root. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Ukata in the Subhaga Grove at the root of a loyal sala tree. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied, and the Blessed One said this, standard opening. "Bhikkhus, I shall teach you a discourse on the root of all things. Listen and attain closely to what I shall say." "Yes, Venerable Sir," the monks replied, the Blessed One said this. Now these subheadings here can be helpful. This is the section for the ordinary person, otherwise known as the Putujana, which in Buddhism means those who aren't streamers yet, or above. Here, monks, an untaught ordinary person who has no regard for the noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their dharma, who has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their dharma, again, that is just a standard way of saying a putujana, in other words, not a stream winner. So it's just standard idiom. So such a person perceives earth as earth. Having perceived earth as earth, he conceives himself as earth, he conceives himself in earth, he conceives himself apart from earth, he conceives earth to be mine, he delights in earth. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. Or, he perceives water as water, having perceived water as water, he conceives himself as water, he conceives himself in water, he conceives himself apart from water. He conceives water to be mine, and he delights in water. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. Or he perceives fire as fire. Having perceived fire as fire, he conceives himself as fire. He conceives himself in fire. He conceives himself apart from fire. He conceives fire to be mine. He delights in fire. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. Or he perceives air as air. Having perceived air as air, he conceives himself as air. He conceives himself in air. He conceives himself apart from air. He conceives air to be mine. He delights in air. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. Those are the four elements. Or he perceives beings as beings. Having perceived beings as beings, he conceives beings. He conceives himself in beings. He conceives himself apart from beings. He conceives beings to be mine. He delights in beings. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. And these are beings of Buddhas. So these are actually quite lower beings. He perceives gods as gods, these are the Devas. Having perceived gods as gods, he conceives gods. He conceives himself in gods, he conceives himself apart from gods. He conceives gods to be mine, he delights in gods. Why is that? Because he's not fully understood it, I say. Or he perceives Prajapati as Prajapati. That's a particular type of god. It's supposed to be here, Lord of creation. That's a name given by the Vedas to the Indra. Having perceived Prajapati as Prajapati, he conceives Prajapati. He conceives himself in Prajapati. He conceives himself apart from Prajapati. He conceives Prajapati to be mine. He delights in Prajapati. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. Or he perceives Brahma as Brahma. Having perceived Brahma as Brahma, he conceives Brahma. He conceives himself in Brahma. He conceives himself apart from Brahma. He conceives Brahma to be mine. He delights in Brahma. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I see. So that's the highest of the gods. I'm not quite sure where Prajapati fits in, but Brahma is the highest of gods. And again, that is equivalent to the first jhana. He perceives the gods of streaming radiance as the gods of streaming radiance. Having perceived the gods of streaming radiance as the gods of streaming radiance, he conceives the gods of streaming radiance. He conceives himself in the gods of streaming radiance. He conceives himself apart from the gods of streaming radiance. Or he conceives the gods of streaming radiance to be mine. And he delights in the gods of streaming radiance. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. And radiance is the second jhana. God's people will get reborn and stay in that second jhana realm. He perceives the gods of refulgent glory as the gods of refulgent glory. It's very hard to make these translations, but refulgent glory. Having perceived the gods of refulgent glory as the gods of refulgent glory, I don't know, myself know what refulgent means, but anyway. He conceives the gods of refulgent glory. He conceives himself in the gods of refulgent glory. He conceives himself apart from the gods of refulgent glory. He conceives the gods of refulgent glory to be mine. He delights in the gods of refulgent glory. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. That's the third jhana. He perceives the gods of great fruit as the gods of great fruit. Having perceived the gods of great fruit as the gods of great fruit, he conceives the gods of great fruit. He conceives himself in the gods of great fruit. He conceives himself apart from the gods of great fruit. He conceives the gods of great fruit to be mine. He delights in the gods of great fruit. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. And that's the fourth jhana, well, the Vaihapala. The next one is a weird one. He perceives the overlord as the overlord. Having perceived the overlord as the overlord, he conceives the overlord. He conceives himself in the overlord. He conceives himself apart from the overlord. He conceives the overlord to be mine. He delights in the overlord. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. Don't you know why that is doing there between the fourth jhana and the next state, which is the infinite space? He perceives the base of infinite space as the base of infinite space. Having perceived the base of infinite space as the base of infinite space, he conceives himself as the base of infinite space. He conceives himself in the base of infinite space. He conceives himself apart from the base of infinite space. He conceives the base of infinite space to be mine. He delights in the base of infinite space. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. He perceives the base of infinite consciousness as the base of infinite consciousness. Having perceived the base of infinite consciousness as the base of infinite consciousness, he conceives himself as the base of infinite consciousness. He conceives himself in the base of infinite consciousness. He conceives himself apart from the base of infinite consciousness. He conceives the base of infinite consciousness to be mine. He delights in the base of infinite consciousness. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. He perceives the base of nothingness in the base of nothingness. Having perceived the base of nothingness as the base of nothingness, he conceives. From perceiving, you conceive. He conceives himself as the base of nothingness. He conceives himself in the base of nothingness. He conceives himself apart from the base of nothingness. He conceives the base of nothingness to be mine, and he delights in the base of nothingness. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. The third arupa. He perceives the base of neither perception or non-perception as the base of neither perception or non-perception. Having perceived the base of neither perception nor non-perception as the base of neither perception or non-perception, he conceives himself as the base of neither perception or non-perception. He conceives himself in the base of neither perception or non-perception. And he conceives himself apart from the base of neither perception or non-perception. He conceives the base of neither perception or non-perception to be mine. And he delights in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Why is this? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. So those are the four immaterials. Now, he perceives the seen as the seen. Having perceived the seen as the seen, he conceives himself as the seen. He conceives himself in the seen. He conceives himself apart from the seen. He conceives what he sees to be mine. He delights in the seen. Why is that? Because he's not fully understood it, I say. He perceives the herd as the herd. Having perceived the herd as the herd, he conceives himself as the herd. He conceives himself in the herd. He conceives himself apart from the herd. He conceives the herd to be mine. He delights in the herd. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. It's a sense that's a sense, and that means what is smelt, what is tasted, or what is touched. Those three are the six senses. Having perceived the sense as the sense, he conceives himself as the sense. He conceives himself in the sense. He conceives himself apart from the sense. He conceives the sense to be mine. He delights in the sense. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. He perceives the cognized as the cognized. This is what you see through the sixth sense of mind. The cognized as the cognized. He conceives himself as the cognized. He conceives himself in the cognized. He conceives himself apart from the cognized. He conceives the cognized to be mine. And he delights in what he knows. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. So those are the six sense objects. He perceives unity as unity. Having perceived unity as unity, he conceives himself as unity. He conceives himself in unity. He conceives himself apart from unity. He conceives unity to be mine, and he delights in unity. Why is that? Because he's not fully understood it, I say. He perceives diversity, let's call it duality, as duality. Having perceived, don't have to do that because that's just me adding to make a point. Diversity is probably better than I'm just stirring things up by calling it duality. Having perceived duality as duality, he conceives himself as duality, he conceives himself in duality, he conceives himself apart from duality, he conceives duality to be mine, he delights in duality. Why is that? Because he's not fully understood it, I say. He perceives all as all. Having perceived the all as all, he conceives himself as all. He conceives himself as in all. He conceives himself apart from all. He conceives all to be mine. He delights in all. Why is that? Because he's not fully understood it, I say. Or perceives Nibbana as Nibbana. Having perceived Nibbana as Nibbana, he conceives himself as Nibbana. He conceives himself in Nibbana. He conceives himself apart from Nibbana. He conceives Nibbana to be mine. He delights in Nibbana. Why is that? Because he has not fully understood it, I say. 26 things there. Summarize those things before we go to the next. It is the four elements. It is the different stages from Buddhas to gods to the jhana realms and the arupa realms to the sense objects and to these mystical ideas of unity or diversity, all and nirvana. And that's an ordinary person. That's how the Putujana works. Now the disciple in high training, this is the stream winner and above. Fortunately, for your comfort, it has been abbreviated. Monks, and remember in those days, these monks listening would have not had it abbreviated. Monks, a monk who is in higher training, which is stream winner, once returner, non-returner, whose mind has not yet reached the goal, and who is still aspiring to the supreme security from bondage, directly knows earth as earth. I see he is not perceiving it, directly knowing it as earth. Having directly known earth as earth, he should not conceive himself as earth. He should not conceive himself in earth. He should not conceive himself apart from earth. He should not conceive earth to be mine. He should not delight in earth. Why is that? Because he must fully understand it, I say. He directly knows all these other things as they are. And lastly, Nibbana. He directly knows Nibbana as Nibbana. Having directly known Nibbana as Nibbana, he should not conceive himself as Nibbana. He should not conceive himself in Nibbana. He should not conceive himself apart from Nibbana. He should not conceive Nibbana to be mine. He should not delight in Nibbana. Why is that? Because he must fully understand it, I say. This is extremely, you see, this is not perceiving, this is directly knowing these things, to make sure you don't do these things which the Putucana had. Now don't worry about this, I'm going to give you a summary at the very end, on a nice sheet of paper, so you don't even need to make notes. Now the Arahat, this is one enlightened. Monks, a monk is an Arahat with the taint, the outflowings destroyed, who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached his own goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and is completely liberated through final knowledge. See how we like synonyms. So you say it one way, two ways, three ways, just like you see in a dictionary or thesaurus, just to make sure you know exactly what he's talking about. So these are common synonyms. Lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and is completely liberated through final knowledge, or taints destroyed. These are ways of saying when enlightened. He too directly knows earth as earth, just like the stream winner. Having directly known earth as earth, he does not conceive himself as earth. He does not conceive himself in earth. He does not conceive earth to be mine. He does not delight in earth. Why is that? Because he has fully understood it, I say. So that's the difference between the stream winner. The stream winner is told not to do these things. The Arahat has done them. I'll explain it later on. Monks, a monk with an Arahat, completely liberated through final knowledge, he too directly knows earth as earth. Having directly known earth as earth, he does not conceive himself as earth, he does not conceive himself in earth, he does not conceive himself apart from earth, he does not conceive earth to be mine, he does not delight in earth, as with all the other four elements, stages of being, jhanas, the sense objects, all these mystical things, the all, the diversity, the unity, and nirvana. Why is that? Because he is free from lust through the destruction of lust. And it also goes for number three, because he is freed from hatred, he is free from delusion through the destruction of these things. The Arahat 3 and 4. I have abbreviated for you there. So the first one was because he has fully understood it, then because he is free from lust, because he's free from hate, from free from delusion. That's Arahat 2, 3, and 4. The Tathagata, that's always the way the Buddha would regard himself as the last God. Tathagata. Because the Tathagata too, accomplished in fully enlightened, directly knows earth as earth. Having directly known earth as earth, he does not conceive himself as earth. He does not conceive himself in earth. He does not conceive himself apart from earth. He does not conceive earth to be mine. He does not delight in earth. Why is that? Because the Tathagata has fully understood it to the end, I say, and with all these other things. So with the ordinary Arahat, they have fully understood it. And to the Buddha it says, fully understood it to the end. Now, we'll mention that later. What's the difference between fully understanding it? If it's full, it's full. So what does it mean? fully understanding it to the end. And he's saying with all the other of these qualities, the elements, the jhanas, the stages of being, the arupa states, the sense objects, and also these mystical things. The Tathagata too, months. The Tathagata too, accomplishing fully enlightened, directly knows earth as earth. Having directly known earth as earth, he does not conceive himself as earth, does not conceive himself in earth, does not conceive himself apart from earth, does not conceive earth to be mine. He does not delight in earth. Why is that? Because he's understood that delight is the root of suffering. As condition, there is birth. And that for whatever has come to... Sorry, I should start that again so I don't cough. Why is that? Because he has understood that delight is the root of suffering, and that with being as a condition, there is birth. And that for whatever has come to be, there is aging and death. Therefore, months of the complete destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishing of craving, the Tathagata has awakened to the Supreme Full Enlightenment. And the same with all these other qualities, because he has understood that delight is the root of suffering, and with being as condition, this is bhava, there is birth, that's the last stage of the dependent origination, and that for whatever has come to be, there is aging and death, in other words, suffering. Therefore, marks with the complete destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishing of craving, the Tathagata is awakened to the Supreme Full Enlightenment, I say. And that's the same with all of these other qualities. That is what the Blessed One said, but those monks did not delight in the Blessed One's words. Now, first of all, if you read the former translation of this, which was done by the Pali Text Society for Professor I.B. Horner, who was the auntie of Ajahn Amaro, if you want to know that, when she translated this, a Cambridge don, who was a very good Pali scholar, but unfortunately, being apart from Buddhist monks or nuns or whatever, sometimes made mistakes. And this was one of the mistakes. When she read that in the Pali, which certainly said the monks did not delight, she said, the monks have to delight in it. They always delight in what the Buddha said. So in her translation, she said, the monks did delight in what the Blessed One said, and she assumed that the manuscript which she had was in error. Now, if ever you are doing any translation, be careful of that, because it's not what you think should be the right words. You have to translate what's there, whether you like it or not, whether you think it's correct or not. You have to be authentic to what you're translating and not add your preferences. Then this one, she got it totally wrong. It was, everyone admits the monks did not delight in this one, because they didn't understand a word of it, basically. It was over their heads. And apparently the Buddha did that on purpose, just actually to humble them, because they were arrogant, they thought they knew it all. And of course, if you ever teach it, there's always people who think they know it all. And I remember even when I was with Ajahn Chah, once this Zen monk, he thought he was enlightened, came up to Ajahn Chah. And out of the great compassion of this young, he was a Westerner, he wanted to enlighten Ajahn Chah, and he was asking these profound questions of Ajahn Chah, and every now and again he bang something. Because apparently in Zen that's how you enlighten someone. You bring mindfulness to the moment. He was laughing his head off. So the funniest thing you saw is eccentric Westerner. So sometimes people are very arrogant. So the Buddha, be careful. I don't understand me. So that was the case where these monks were very arrogant. So this is it. The monks never understood what the Buddha said here. And it is a very difficult one to understand, first of all. And the key comes, I remember Bhikkhu Bodhi did a very excellent treatise on this. In the very end he gave a couple of appendixes here, which actually put all the sutta together in a nice, easy to understand form, which makes it very easy to understand. So I've only printed 11 of these. So would you be able to give some out? And have you got copies from last time you were here?
Yeah, appreciate it.
But let somebody else give out. Maybe you could give them out, Kim? If you could share, or you just want to listen, maybe, you've got a couple there. Aha! So how many have you got there? So, okay, then maybe could you keep one for yourself and share one with somebody else?
Yes.
There we go. Go, Max. So look at the appendix here. This is actually from Bhikkhu Bodhi. So if you don't get one, you haven't got merit, but never mind. You can share it if you wish. Look in the appendix here. Here, good old Bhikkhu Bodhi, out of compassion for everybody, put it in a nice scheme, so it's much easier for Westerners to understand. So, on the left-hand column, you have the different types of individual, the uninstructed worldly, which is those who aren't even streamwinner yet. And the next, second row, is the learner. This is the streamwinner, the once-returner, or the non-returner. And the fourth row is the arahat, fully enlightened. And the last row at the bottom is the Buddha. So this is telling you the difference between the putuchana, the stream winner, the arahat, and the Buddha. And the next row, or next column rather, is the primary cognition. It's very specifically mentioned in the suttas, but this is just a very good way for Bhikkhu Bodhi to explain this. You perceive something. It's basic perception, the same for all of these four groups of people. So we have the four elements, the earth, air, fire, and water. This is just perceiving a thing, perceiving a brick, perceiving a sausage, perceiving a cake, you know, perceiving a person, perceiving a beautiful girl, or perceiving a crow. So those first four bases are just things. The next basis are perceiving the various stages of being. The Buddhas, the Devas, the gods, especially perceiving these states of jhana immaterial realms, or perceiving the objects of the senses, the seen, the heard, the sensed, the cognized. And after that, we came to these weird cases, the unity, diversity, or nirvana, these conceptual ultimate realities. Now, from all these different things which you perceive, the initial response is different here from the uninstructed worldling to the learner, the arahat, the Buddha. The initial response in this sutta, they say, the uninstructed worldling, they just perceive it. In other words, they take it for granted that a cake is a cake, that God is a God, that the jhana is a jhana, that the sense, what you see, what is real, what you hear, what you sense, what you know, is what's known. That the all is the all, that God is God. That diversity, unity, that even nirvana is nirvana. The reason is because you don't directly know it. So for the stream winner, as with the arahat and the Buddha, they directly know these things. Now this direct knowing, just to make it clear, this direct knowing, the word actually here in Pali, is mean this is your understanding. If that was me, I would actually put directly understands this. It's a view which is being purified. I'd put directly understands. Go on.
Is this directly knowing all the time because it directly understands.
So the knowing, that's why I didn't like the word know, it's an understanding. Your view is purified. Now here, the initial response to perception is that. And then the conceptual response, as you perceive something, so you conceive it, so you think about it, you interpret your perceptions. And here we have the conceptual response, so the uninstructed world, you have to perceive it just your bare perception, trusting in your bare perception, you conceive that this is you, that you are in this, you are derived from this, that this is you. When you say the conceiving here, it's very much meant, and this is accurate to the way that this word manyati is used in Pali. This is the conception of a self. When you see us, you see a person, I see Buddha Rakata, I've got a body like you. So I think, I am this. Or I am somehow in this body. Or I am, got here from, I am apart from the body. Or I am, the body is mine, the ownership, the four senses. More like, this is people who have the materialistic view, have identified themselves with the body. It's amazing, incredible, how many people in modern science age actually conceive themselves as the body, so much so they're terrified of death. They think that when they die, that's the end of all things. Or they conceive themselves as in this body somewhere, just like the Christians believe there's a soul in here somewhere, which floats out. Or even some Buddhists, especially in Malaysia and Singapore, they say that at a funeral service you've got to make sure when the person dies which is the last to get hot, whether it's your head is the last to get hot or the feet the last to get hot. Because if your feet are warm and your head is cold as you die, that means your soul has left the body through the feet and you're going to go to hell. But if your head is hot last and your feet are cold, then your soul has gone through the head up to heaven, then you're okay. They may laugh about that, but that's what people teach. And because of that, they get these monks. And it's not just the Tibetan monks, they're the worst, I must admit. But the Theravada monks get into it as well. And at the person's death, they chant, 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 chant. And then they feel the head, and it's warm. They've gone to heaven. So they get more ang pao, some more red packets with money in it. Because they've done the job, they've got themselves to heaven. And anyone knows as a doctor, the brain is the last one to turn off. So just always, unless you're very weird, so the head is the last thing to lose its heat when you die. So they scallywags, but that's actually what they believe. Or you somehow conceive that you are apart from your body. Who's got here from? In this one over here, which is, this is the later translation book of Bodhi, he's got apart from these things, which is a much better translation. You are, but you're not, you're apart from these things. Or that the body is mine, which is very common. Conception of the self. Now, I'm going to go on with the other things. First of all, then you can ask a question. Or you think that you are, especially the gods, these are the higher things, that you are a god, if you ever get reborn in that place. Or that in this bodily form, you are somehow a soul which is inside of this. Or that you are a god, but you are apart from it. Or this particular form is what you possess. I am Brahma, I possess this form forever, for eternity. Or, when you get into the jhana realms, either after death or right now, you can see this jhana is your essence. And this is very common, especially when people get into deep meditation. This is it. It's an incredibly powerful, blissful state. This is the real me. Or somehow you're contained in this. Or you are out there experiencing the jhana. You're apart from that jhana. All the jhana is yours, you attach to it. And all those jhanas, or you go into what you sense. In other words, you conceive that what you sense is you. So when you are sensing pain, you think, I am hurting. When you're experiencing beauty, what you see, I am experiencing that beauty. Or you're somehow in that sensory world. Or that you are a part just watching that sensory world. Or that sensory world is yours. What's seen, what's heard, smelled, tasted, touched, or known, that's mine. Or, give you a chance in a moment. Or, you think the all. No, it's a unity. The one. I am the one. Or somehow I'm included in the one. just a drop in the great ocean of being, but I'm in it. Or I somehow can sort of observe the One, and this detached, unborn, ungenerated jitter which could be apart from this and know it. Or that the One is mine. Or the diversity, which is uncommon, the diversity, that's what I am. I am a diverse universe. Or somehow I'm included in it. Or I'm a part watching this. Or this diverse universe is mine. Or the All. Now if that was today, they'd have a few more things there. Or the ground of being, cosmic consciousness, original mind, whatever it is. All these things, you can see this is the essence of me. Or somehow I'm inside of this. Or I'm apart from this, watching outside. Or this is mine. Even Nibbana, you can see Nibbana. You don't know it yet, you just perceive it. And you can see Nibbana, that's me. So people have got some weird ideas of what Nibbana is. You read some of these books, and people have some great ideas of what Nibbana is. The weirdest idea of Nibbana was when I first came to Perth 26 years ago. This guy came and saw Ajahn Chakravarti, and they had a little bit of a chat, and afterwards he said, yeah, in my teacher, in my system, I don't know what system it was, we believe in Nibbana as well. And we're going to go there as well. Nibbana is a planet just beyond Uranus. That's where we go to. That's what he said. That's a weird idea of what Nibbana is, a planet which has not yet been discovered just beyond Uranus. Fair enough. So you can see Nibbana, I haven't got a clue what it is. You see, this is me. Or somehow you're in Nibbana. I've attained Nibbana, I'm in it. Or that somehow you're separate from Nibbana. Just watching it. Or Nibbana is you, you've owned it. You've got there. I have Nibbana. Now each one of those is wrong. You've got to say, this is the unobstructed worldview. Why do you don't understand it? And the result of that is you delight in these things. Because you conceive these things as something to do with you, therefore you delight in it. You delight in the elements. You delight in your food, in your house. You delight in your car. You delight in your partner. You delight in things. Or you delight in beings, being a god. You delight in the jhanas, in the jhana realms, in the immaterial realms. You delight in the sense, in the seeing, the heard, the sense, the cognize. You delight in knowing things, which is why your mind can't be still. You delight in the All, oh no, in the unity, in the One. You worship the One. You worship diversity. You worship the All. You worship Nibbana. You delight in it. And the reason? Because you haven't fully understood it, says the Buddha. That's the uninstructed worldview. Okay, you had a question, Daniel?
What do you think in the five reasons how you think that part can
Okay. Is it
just because it's not substantial, or is it just
a clarified substance? Okay, it is. It's like you can know these things, but you are like standing outside. It's like you are watching a movie. That, you know, you can see the movie, you can delight in it, you can have fun with it, but you remember you're sitting by the seat. There's a being there. You're not quite sure what that being is. But you are apart, watching, observing. That's a very powerful one, because that's a place where a lot of people get stuck. They say, yeah, we know sort of the five senses, six senses, and not being a mind of myself. Yeah, we know that sort of the five khandhas, nothing to do with me, they're transient, they're suffering, non-self. But there's something, some original mind, which is apart from all of this, which is not part of the khandhas, not part of the senses. It is apart from these things. Something like that. It's something, there is a being, an essence, apart, say, from the five khandhas. apart from the senses, apart from the all, apart from nirvana. Yeah.
I thought about when you said that something, seeing the body, hearing and remembering stuff.
That's just a way of seeing. That is the mind-made body.
So what is mind?
So what is the mind? It's a process, not a thing. That's why. Now you're going to get confused. When the Buddha said in this wonderful sutta, when he said you can't say there is something because there is a fading away, a dissolution seen. You can't say there is nothing because an arising is seen. Is that I teach the middle way between isness and non-isness, and that is the process of dependent origination. So instead of saying is and not is, I've translated ati and nati pretty accurately. Or interesting, or easy to understand. I don't say there is nothing, because an arising is seen. But nor do I say there is persistence. As soon as it arises, it passes away. And I've used a symbol from mathematics, you're a scientist, like the point. The point in space has got no extension, no length. But it's not nothing. It's in between. And arising almost into existence. But as soon as it arises, it's passing away. It's a process, not a thing. Waterfall, no, you see waterfall. It's much more subtle. A point in mathematics is much better. Yeah. That's one of them, yes. You can't have something apart from that. So when the two fall down, you think, ah, but I can see that, so it must be apart from it. That's a wrong metaphor.
The perceptions of the world meaning just so totally unreliable.
Correct.
Can one only really trust the words of the Aryans?
So you don't know who's an Aryan, that's a problem. So you can perceive someone as an Aryan, you might get it wrong. Mm-hmm. So that's a trouble. So you perceive someone X as an Aryan, then you can see them as such. So it's, again, it's unreliable. The only way, have you said for a part?
Then I thought to myself that if there's doubt, if one doubts everything, then it can lead to a lot of fear because you don't know what to trust.
Indeed, sometimes people do have that. So, Eightfold Path is best.
Mm, so, one can trust the instruction of the Aryans.
Yep. And but the best Aryans are just what's in the book.
Mm.
Because many monks and nuns. And you may have heard some who say they're Aryans, some who say they're streamers, one who turns, one who turns, and Arahant. And even in the time of the Buddha said, some of them are, some of them ain't. So you can't even trust what they say. In the time of the Buddha, you could trust it. How much less now?
Because then, it seems like the mind does need some sort of something to trust, otherwise it sort of goes towards an extreme of some sort of annihilation.
Yes, so what you should trust is the mind, which is free of the hindrances.
And if it's not the mind that one's experiencing, then it would be what one understands the mind of another one.
Yeah, well, the time being, just this is okay for now, but I'm not really going to trust the boat, give me music or nothing else. And your whole job is to get rid of the five hindrances so you can actually see clearly. That's going to come up soon. So let's see what the stream would have. They perceive something like everybody else, but the learner, the Arahant, the Buddha, they know these things and exactly what they are. In particular, you've understood, you've got the right view. This is the understanding, the view. There is no self. There is no me, no my, not a self. It's just a process. The Buddha said that if you see the Dhamma, you see dependent origination. You see dependent origination, you see the Dhamma. He also said, the one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. You've actually seen something, you've understood, you've got insight. Therefore, So you can still conceive these things as you, or in you, or you're apart from these things, or these are you. You can still do that. Sometimes you forget. Your mind is not strong. Your view is not informed, or your conception yet. So therefore, this is the training of the Arya. Make sure that you stop this conceptual process of taking this thing to be you, that you're somehow included in these things, that you're apart from these things, just watching on or whatever, or you own these things. And together with that, make sure you don't delight in these things. Because whenever you conceive them as you, you're in this, you're watching these things, or you own these things, then you delight in them. And in order that you may fully understand or fully know these things, so your understanding is partial, not in its depth, but in its maintaining constant understanding. The Arahat, they perceive it, they directly know it, just like the stream winner, and now their training is finished. They don't need to be told, let you not do these things, they've done it, so they never conceive any of things, these things as a self. It's in the jhana, whether it's just what they sense, any being in the universe, even any mystical conceptual understanding like an all, and diversity, unity, nirvana, they never think that they are nirvana, or they're somehow included in nirvana, or they're apart from nirvana, or they own nirvana. So they don't delight in these things. They don't even delight in nirvana. Because they've fully understood these things, and because they're devoid of lust, hatred, and delusion. And lastly, the Buddha, what's the difference between the Buddha and Arahat? Like the Arahat, they perceive these things, they directly understood these things when they were streaming them, and they too don't conceive these things as themselves, or themselves included in these things, or themselves apart from any of these things, or them as being an owner of these things. And of course they don't delight in them. And why? Because they have fully understood these things to the end. So their understanding is deeper. Still full enough for the purpose of enlightenment, but with a wider rather than a deeper understanding. But also, because they've understood dependent origination. Now, to understand it even more fully, if you turn the sheets, now we have one of the great Buddhist teachings of the Vipalasa. And Vipalasa means like the perversion of view, perception and thought. This is what's called the root of delusion. And when I first came upon this, I thought, wow, what a great teaching of the Buddha, what a great psychologist he was. That wherever you start with those three things, view, perception and thought, it becomes what we call like the vicious cycle. Say you have a view, any view which you like, such as Jesus Christ is the only saviour of the world, and without believing in Jesus you'll go to hell. Once you have that view, that bends your perception. In other words, what you see in life, the way you see, hear, sense, cognize, will always be bent by that view. Basically, to fulfill that view. Anything which does not conform to your view, you will reject. It's called denial. And any evidence, you know, which, you know, you pray to God, and today you don't die. Hallelujah! It's a miracle. You see, the reason I didn't die today was because I prayed to God. No other reason, not the fact that you're not sick. That's got nothing to do with it. So you can see that actually changes your perception. And because of perceptions, there's this bare seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, knowing. What we take as our bare information for life. We thought, we conceive. So we think, wow. See, let's get a better example. Somebody in Singapore told me, one desperate mother whose child had poor hearing took them to one of these evangelical meetings to be cured. And so eventually when it came to their turn, one of his revival meetings, he took her son on stage, and the pastor came up to him, "Praise the Lord, hallelujah, come over here, Jesus will save you." And he shouted into this child's ear, "Can you hear me?" And the child said, "Yes, hallelujah, he can hear." And the mother said, "Of course he can hear, he hasn't got no hearing, he just, if you shout at him, of course you can hear, he just can't hear ordinary hearing." But of course, by that time, everyone was hallelujahing all over the place. It was a miracle. And you can see there, because they had the view that Jesus is going to cure you, their perceptions, they perceived it as a cure. And because of that perception of a cure, they all thought another evidence for sort of the marvellous Jesus. And that made their views even stronger. Views, perception, thoughts. Another example. You see this beautiful girl. For your viewers, you know, the girls are beautiful. This is for the boys. And because you have that, you actually see them as beautiful. Are they really beautiful? You actually can't, when you've got that view, they're beautiful, that's all you can perceive, they're lovely. When you fall in love, "Oh, she's the most beautiful girl in the whole world. I'm so lucky that she's going out with me." And other people, what do you mean that she's got crooked teeth? And her terrible, she's got spots all over her, she stinks. But you can't see that when you're in love. She's perfect. And because that's actually how you see it. You perceive it as that. And then because you perceive it, you think about it all the time. "This is just a wonderful girl, and I'm so happy, I'm in love." And that makes your view even stronger. You go around this circle. But after a few years in love, when you got married, then you sort of get upset at each other. And your view is, "That bastard bitch." If that's your view, you're really upset about it, then every time you look at it, you can see, she's doing it again. Your whole perception changes, and you can only see what you don't dislike. And so you have all her faults. And when you get like that, you keep thinking about her. She's a terrible woman. Why did I do that? I must have been dumb. I must have been stupid. And that changes your whole view, because your perceptions are negative, you think negative, your view becomes negative. So this is a delusion.
I think if you have a view that you are a prophet, you are
much better. Your view, your process, then you can perceive it as a process, then you think as a process. It's actually a right view. It's a helpful view. So what is the difference between right view and wrong view? If you approve each other, the right view is a view which will get you out of the cycle. Anything which gets you out is called right view. Later on, right view is actually what's true. But you can't know that yet. For example, you have the view that sex is fun, is enjoyable. And that's a view which has been conditioned into most human beings. And because they have that view, if you have sex, you perceive it as enjoyable. It actually feels that way. And then you think sex is enjoyable. And you have a view that sex is fun. And the Buddha, I mention this because this is one of the things the Buddha said to Ananda. He said, "This is a perversion of perception. You've got it wrong." However, telling people that, they say, "Ajahn Brahm, you are weird, you are crazy. You've just been a monk for too long, you should get out in the real world," people tell me. But it's no, that if you have a view like that, it actually, you test it out, it is fun. It's not fun, you're perceiving it as fun, you're thinking it as fun, you're viewing it as fun, and that is what creates the delusion. That's why these things are very dangerous. When you find out what's actually going on, and you understand this, you understand why people are deluded. And why they do some stupid things in this world. People, for example, believe that extreme sports, like riding, one of the most stupid extreme sports I saw when I was a kid. You know, the speedway racing on motorbikes going 160, 200 miles an hour around this circuit. Now, that's stupid enough, but this one I saw was on ice. They frozen the track with ice, and they went around these motorbikes. I had to put chains with spikes on the wheels. And just as they came off, they just spiked themselves. And I was always doing this. And that's the most crazy thing in the world to do. Why would anybody want to do that? You ask them, because it's fun. They have a view, it's fun, exciting, and that actually changes their perception. When they're on that bike, it is really fun. And afterwards they think about it, they can't get right to get back to the next race. You have been deluded. Most of the things you think are fun are not fun.
That's just a quick question, talking about sexuality. But yes, it's fairly obvious, I think, if you look at the world, that more suffering from homosexuality than actually joy. It just seems that way, you know, there's more misery associated with relationships and all that sort of stuff.
So why do you do it?
Why do I do it? That's a point.
Yeah, it's a great point, because I remember as a school, people near your friends would say, that's really good fun. Let's go out with the girls. Let's go dance parties. It's fun. I was told it was fun. I remember one occasion, this was in the late 60s, and people were getting into these drugs, like me today, and one of my mates, there was a rumour going around, this was in the LSD times, that if you take a banana peel and put it in,
the banana peel, I think you're a lover, you're in that as well,
and put it in some foil, and you let it go rotten for a few days, then that actually gets this, this drug, which is like peyote or something similar. When you take that, you really get high. So I remember one of my mates tried it, and afterwards, how is it? He said, oh, it's amazing, it's wonderful, it's great. And it's, now yes, he felt that way, but you know, he found out later it's absolutely a myth. But because he viewed it's going to be high, he perceived it that way, and he became high. Yes, he enjoyed it, and I was there, I saw him, he was having a great time. This is a trouble, view, perception, thought, it's a placebo effect as well. Yes.
With sexuality, is it such a strong force because of procreation?
Probably it's procreation, but it's also because of our culture. You're brainwashed since you're young, thinking it's fun.
Do you think it's always been that way, or is it just a modern thing? Like it's really.
Oh, it's been there for a long time. Yeah. I don't know why. I just. And the other one I know is beer. Yeah, because I was in a culture with, you know, having a pint of beer was the most wonderful thing to do. People spent days, weeks, their whole life trying to get down the pub. As soon as work was over, or lunchtime, weekends, go down the pub. I remember as a 14-year-old getting my first half pint of beer. You know, found sort of, you know, totally illegal, but you know, boys being boys, that's what you do. And at last I thought, this is interesting, this is what everyone else is really doing. It was disgusting. I thought, what is everybody on about? This is the most disgusting thing to put in your mouth and swallow. You had to do it. It only took about 6 months and it was delicious. The only reason it was delicious, because it had to be. I had to change my perception because my views, my culture, said this is delicious. And after a while it was. That's actually how it brainwashes. Brainwash the culture. Duty, or what's enjoyable, what's not enjoyable. Totally vanish.
I don't mean like trying to overcome the views of the world, you know? Is it a matter of like mindfulness and what's up in the past?
That's something else I'm going to go on for a minute, actually, how you change this whole cycle. The first thing the Buddha is saying here, just know the cycle exists. When you really understand how the cycle exists, it is terrifying. Because one thing which a lot of people trust is what they call bare perception. What you see, what you hear, what you feel, you take to be absolute truth. And you build all of your theories, all of your ideas on this, what you think is bare perception. And the Buddha is saying here, by the time you see, things have been bent. Even what you see, what comes to your brain or your mind, has been filtered. You haven't known it's been filtered. You're only seeing what you want to see. And what you don't like to see has been filtered out. What you hear is only what you want to hear. What you don't like to hear, filtered out. Go on.
I was going to say one question I was going to ask earlier.
Yes.
All these things except direct knowledge seem to be constructs or conceptions. So perception is a conception.
Well, perception has also been constructed. That's a terrible thing to know.
Yeah.
all St. Carl, St. Carl is constructed, built, beautifully built by this process, not a self, the process.
Including your life.
Delight is part of that, because you think and you delight in particular types of ideas that creates the views.
So anything other than direct knowing is a construct.
Absolutely.
And clear perception is actually not so normal, isn't it?
Correct. It's not there at all.
Yeah.
And that's actually really struck me when I saw it. Gee, I trusted in this. I trusted in what I saw. Actually, I saw you sitting there. That's Martin. I don't trust it anymore.
If you refer to the stimuli, sometimes you refer to the stimuli as one who's on the way to being a stimuli.
Aha, yeah.
Are you referring to that here, or is it when the person...
No, this is the one who's the paper stimuli.
Mm-hmm. And that's through, to acknowledge you refer to actually the event of the meditation and seeing the truth of the truth.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Just to be on the shade side, if you can sort of find
that's much better. We'll go to that in a moment, because on the right hand side of this whole process these are the main delusions which this whole process of view, bending perception, bending thought, bending view, you don't know which one comes first, and it's the main thing is seeing what is impermanent is permanent, what is permanent is impermanent. So it's getting it totally wrong. Now it's amazing just how many people think they're going to live forever. It's amazing how many people think this monastery is going to be there forever. It's amazing how many people think their intelligence is going to be here forever. That all the things that you've studied and known, you're going to remember. I'm going to see my poor old mum in another 2 or 3 weeks' time, she's got dementia. So, even her knowledge and understanding, even her memory of me is impermanent. People get terrified of that. She's happy, I'm happy. Just part of life, that's all. Sometimes people meditate and they get into jhanas and they can't get it back again. Of course it's impermanent, what do you expect? But a lot of times, you take what is impermanent as being permanent. Your will. The one in charge, or the ability to charge, is that permanent or impermanent? Of course it's impermanent. You cannot be the one in charge. Your consciousness, that which knows, is that permanent? But it's impermanent. But even monks take that the jitter as permanent. Stupid. Or take what is painful to be happy. That's why I get sex. Marriage. The happiest day of my life, when I got married. Or what else is happiness? When your team wins the competition, and Austria win the World Cup. Woo! Is that happiness or suffering? It's amazing how many people follow sport. And I sussed that out years ago. If you follow sport, how many teams in a competition? 32 or 64 or something, 63 of those teams are going to lose. Your chance of happiness is 1 out of 64. And if you do manage to win that year, how long does it last for? I mean, the day or something you celebrate and forget about it, go back to work. So, 1 out of every 64 years, you have one day's happiness. The rest of 64 years, you get miserable. How people do really get miserable when their team loses? They get depressed. Absolute craziness why people follow that dumb game, whatever dumb game is. But I think it's happiness. Or even worse, you go to see movies. Have you watched a movie? Oh, it's so wonderful movie. Where they fall in love at the very end. Despite all of the odds against them, they meet. And they were meant for one another. Absolute craziness. You take that to be happiness. So all this other stuff is taken to be happiness in this world. Is it really happiness? And suffering. What's suffering? Eating one meal a day, wearing white clothes, no TV, no radio, staying in a monastery. People feel you're dumb actually coming in. They say, why don't you get out in the world?
enjoy yourself, go traveling. There's so many things you can see. Have you seen the Great Wall of China? Have you seen sort of the Amazon? You haven't experienced things yet, Max. What are you thinking about? Come to a monastery for a second. They think you're dumb. And worst of all, sitting cross-legged. We had the kids from Christchurch here the other day. That's really good fun. We were talking to them. So, you know, a monk said, what are you celibate for? I said, because it's fun. What do you mean it's fun not having a girlfriend? He said, it's much more fun. He said, you're weird. That must be suffering not having a girlfriend. Can you go watch the TV? No. That must be so much suffering. You can't watch the TV. Can you go to the footy? No, I can't go to the footy. Wow, you're really missing out on life. So they take what is suffering to be happiness. And, most important, take what is non-self to be yourself. Now you notice over here, haven't got the opposite here, to take what is self to be a non-self. There is no such thing as a self. This is what is non-self to be a self. And you know what those things are? The body, the will, the consciousness. That's a total delusion. However, it feels like there's someone in there. Once you have a view of a self, then you'll perceive. Yes, sir, I can see it. I can feel it, I know it. And then you can see, yeah, there is a self. That comes to self-view. Perpetuating. Self-perpetuating. Therefore, people who say there is a soul there, they're having a logical, valid, justifying, it appears to them, I acknowledge to them, it is on a foundation of truth. Unfortunately, it's a false foundation, a view, perception, of thought. It appears justified, logical, reason, according to their personal experience. This sort of answers a lot of questions of why intelligent people can believe in stupid things. You know, I think it was some time ago, this Heaven's Gate, a cult, where these were highly educated people. There was a comet coming towards the Earth, and they thought there was a spaceship just behind the comet. And the comet was going to hit the Earth and destroy the whole Earth. And the only way to escape was actually to commit suicide, and then they'd get reborn on this spacecraft behind the comet. A lot of people killed themselves. And I can understand that. Why was that the case? If they had that view, and that was conditioned into you, they perceive it, think that way, and their intelligence would not be able to break this cycle, because intelligence was part of this cycle, not outside of it. Your view, perception, intelligent thinking would justify that view, justify the perception, strengthen the thinking, strengthen the view. That's how delusion works. Why it's such a difficult cycle to stop, is self-perpetuating. The other things here which the Buddha said, the ugly is beautiful, the beautiful is ugly. Now, the question comes, how does that cycle get broken? And the answer is, by breaking the five hindrances. That's where the Buddha said it's the five hindrances are the nutriment of delusion. So when you have five hindrances, you'll be perpetuating the cycle. Can you understand why? So what's the first hindrance? Yeah. So you see what you want to see. You hear what you want to hear. You smell, you taste, you touch what you want to touch. You know what you want to know. From desire, from wanting. What's the second hindrance? Call in psychology denial. I don't want to see the beauty in the person I hate. I don't want to see their redeeming qualities. You can't see them. When you hate, you deny any positive attribute of that person or thing which you hate. See, the philosophy again, delusion. So when you have desire or ill will, you're not seeing the truth. Obviously, sloth and torpor, you're just too dull to see the truth. Restlessness, You're not being there long enough to see the truth. And doubt, is this the truth? Is it not the truth? What is the truth? I don't know where it's going on. Doubt is a specific form of restlessness. Again, where you don't trust long enough just to see. What I put doubt is when you're doing like a scientific experiment. Instead of just collecting the data, you start to sort of question before you've got all the evidence in. Wait till all the evidence is in. So those five hindrances, especially the first two, is what bends your perception. So you perceive what you want to see. You don't perceive what's there. Yes, don't you? That's part of it, because this is another great perception or understanding of the Buddha. Was where he said, whenever there is a self, there would always be something which the self owns. That's what the self does. That's its function. Own and control to do something. So wherever there is the sense of self, if you think this body is yours, or the mind is yours, or the will is yours, you'd always be doing something with that which you think is you. Where there is a self, there's something belonging to the self, said the Buddha. So sometimes, even in philosophy, we define a thing not by what it is, but what it does. What's its function? And so, the function of the self is to own things. It doesn't own things, it doesn't exist. That's why I was just talking earlier, talking about democracies. In many countries, to have a franchise, be able to vote, you have to be a householder, or at least rent a property. You have to hold something, you have to own something. In the early democracies, you had to own quite a lot to actually have a vote. With the owning made you exist. And that's why there is a monk, as far as the Australian tax office is concerned, I don't exist. Because I don't earn a salary. Because I don't own anything. To many government departments, I don't exist. Who are you anyway? What you own? Your possessions? Your position? I am an abbot. If I own that, then that's what I'll become. If I'm intelligent, I'm stupid. If you own that, that's what you are. You find that you become what you own. That's why being and owning are just two parts of the same, two sides of the same coin. So that's where the owning comes in. When you're there, craving will happen. From devolution, the sense of the self, the sense of mind. And that's where craving begins. When you disappear and you own nothing, craving stops. People who have a big ego have big craving. They want to own the whole world. They want to be Prime Minister and President or CEO of a big company. You ever notice why CEOs have big salaries? Because they've got big egos. The bigger they are, the more they want. That's why monks have no salary. And you don't exist. You don't want anything. Yes.
The five hindrances basically deny the three characteristics.
They don't deny, the five hindrances deny them. I suppose they do, they deny you seeing them and accepting them.
Because I thought, but when there's craving for an object in the five sense world, it's almost like the craving gives it a perception of solidarity.
Solidarity, and the fact you can't own it, you can't possess it. Just work harder and then you get it.
Mm-hmm.
You can own the beautiful house, you can own the Ferrari car. Don't come here, just work a bit harder. And then you can own everything and be happy. Find a nice girl and own her and own your kids. That's why relationships get very tough, because there's a lot of ownership of the partner. Anything me, it's all been mine. Maybe it's not yours anymore. You didn't know me. I'm not even here. Very good.
Oh, yeah. what is the unbeautiful? Is it just the mind adding something?
Actually, what is the beautiful? It is just basically just conditioning again. It's just brainwashed. Look, when I was young, sort of, well, how old am I? 58. When I was 40 years ago, you know, he looks at sort of like a girl and she's really beautiful. Look at a picture of the man now. I said, gee, did I think that was beautiful? Well, I think now. And just, you could go back even more years. And I think in the 120 years ago, these fat girls, plump girls, were supposed to be beautiful. Well, I'll never go out with one of those, because they're fat. And I wonder what boy is beautiful. At a funeral, funeral yesterday, who was there? John was there. Do you see that picture of the guy when he married Pearlie? He was wearing this, that must be 70s suit. And I just got myself laughing. He was a real dork. But that was considered to be really beautiful and really sort of fashionable in those days. Do you remember that picture? It's amazing. So, what is beautiful? What is ugly? Because a lot of it, if you look at the fashion, it's just taught what's ugly. Be skinny or be fat with girls. Or fashion what's ugly. I mean, look at the punks. That was supposed to be fashionable and beautiful when you've got a few razor blades hanging out of your ear. What is beautiful, I think? It's added. A lot of it is added by our culture. Yeah? Because out there in the world, no one talks like this. And people think you're crazy to talk like this. Look at what I said here. If I was on radio doing this, the person sitting next to me would say, you know, that's just really ridiculous. That's crazy. And they wouldn't invite me on anymore, because this is not what the world says, what the world wants for you. What we want to hear is that, well, you know, if you try a bit harder and just don't look at the two bad pics in the wall, but the 998 good pics in the wall, you know, your partner is okay. And it's not sort of, you know, you get sort of cancer every now and again, you're dying, but you know, just the demon coming in the Emperor's Palace, be kind to it, and just life goes on. And if you practice really well, you know, you may go to a heaven realm afterwards. People just like to sort of, you know, just paper over the cracks in life. And just to try and make sort of the suffering just bearable. But I mean, you're stuck. You're in the human realm. It's going to hurt. You know it's going to hurt. Why did it hurt? If you want to get in line, there's a way. Why is it that it's just so hard? I've taught for a long time now, Jhana, but this is better than sex. But why can't you do it? The instructions are very easy and very clear. Why can't you do it? What's stopping you? Your whole mental process is flawed. And a lot of people, especially Westerners, they live and they trust their mind. As you think, so you work it out. And so you trust that therefore you can find out the truth. You look at this and just no matter how much you think and how intelligent you are, if any of these things is flawed, you'll never be able to break out of that cycle. Once you've got a wrong view, you have wrong perception, wrong thought, wrong view, you will not be able to see it. You think it's absolutely logical, it makes sense, it's supported by evidence. either, for example, if he had bombers, they were going to go kill themselves and kill lots of other people. And they're totally convinced that this is a compassionate, wonderful, heroic thing to do. It's religion. They look upon themselves as being superior human beings by doing this. How on earth can anyone do that? Because they have a view that changes their perceptions and their thoughts. How can you have a paedophile who sort of rapes and kills like a 6 or 7 year old? How can anyone do that? Look at you. They are aware.
They're aware,
but their whole view, perception, thought process is totally perverted. It, the thing is, you can't be aware of its truth or its falsity at this particular stage. You take that view, you assume it's right, your perceptions change, it's an all right thing to do. You think that way, your thoughts justify your views, and you get in this cycle. Yes. It's not just other people correcting you. Sometimes even then if people think I was right, there's other people that stopped me doing what was right. We have the conditioning of our views, which again is very strong, and that comes from our society. But then again, you have like an adult Hitler. I'm convinced that Adolf Hitler thought he was doing the right thing.
Well, why Adolf
Hitler? He was a
super soldier.
Yeah, indeed.
That's why he took the name of Lino, King.
Yeah, exactly.
Or
whatever. And you ask these people, say, we thought it through. We're not so stupid people. We're honest, we're brave, we're heroic. And then go and do these things. And if it's on our side, they're heroes. On the other side, they're terrorists and evil. But both sides kill. So this is the whip of houses. Now, how those are actually broken from breaking off or suppressing the 5 hindrances, so you totally have no desire, no wanting to see things this way or that way, no ill will, especially no fear. So whatever is true, you can see that truth whether you like it or you don't. It takes huge amounts of courage to break those hindrances. Because there comes a time, some of you come across this in your meditation, and you come across a barrier of fear. You don't want to go any further. Why is that? Because you have to disappear. You don't want to disappear. Some of you have been coming to mind for a long time. Why aren't you a monk? Or a nun? What's stopping you? Fear. Just don't want to disappear. Seeing truth takes an enormous amount of courage. You have to let go of a lot of things. And sometimes we'd rather not let go. Sometimes in a marriage. Sometimes your partner may be cheating on the marriage. You know it, you just don't want to see it, because it hurts too much. That's an easy to see that type of denial. The deeper denials are really tough. And that's what happens when you come across these barriers of fear, I don't want to go any further. However, it is not the desire to see the truth. That's not strong enough to break those fears. People think that they're honest and they really want to find out the truth, but you can't do that because you don't want it. It hurts. At least you think it hurts too much. The way a person gets enlightened is the joy, the sheer bliss of freedom. I don't want to see the truth, but what the heck, this is just too much fun. That is what pulls the mind into the next stage of meditation. The bliss of renunciation, the joy of letting go. And you get into these deep meditation states, and then your mind is courageous and strong. Whether you like it or not, you come, yes,
is truth.
That's how the hindrances are overcome. Once those hindrances are overcome, why the hell can I see that? It's usually that's one of the things which happens for a streamer. All these years and I couldn't see that. Why? And then you look at these ripple houses. Oh yeah, I understand why now. At the time before, you could not see it, and you understand why you couldn't see it. You need this enormous, what someone once said, this enormous kick up the backside. The biggest kick up the bum you've ever had when you get these powerful dharmas. And they just smash those five hindrances temporarily. Long enough for you actually to see what you don't want to see without fear. The biggest,
what is that you don't want to see? Is it
nothingness? Nothingness, emptiness, cessation. I've taught that fearlessly, and other people say, even actually Ajahn Bhamani, sort of, he wrote this article, and these great scholars in London have said, that's just so depressing. What, Nibbana is nothing? And it's just so black and dull. No one will like that. We're not into marketing this. It's not supposed to be what people sort of feel comfortable with. I could be a very, very famous teacher by telling people what they want to believe. But that's not what you do. So now he got hammered because of that, but why are you afraid of disappearing? What's wrong with cessation? It's the most wonderful thing to realize you don't have to exist anymore. Exactly.
Doesn't sound good at all.
Doesn't sound good at all. Right. Absolutely. From your point of view, my point, oh, it's wonderful. At last I can disappear.
But that's a self-time
meeting. That's right, yeah. That's what you see here. They say what is suffering is happiness. What is happiness is suffering. To me, that's the most blissful, happy thing to know that I'm out of here. But a lot of people want to be.
Go on. The sentence you just said was actually a bit of a contradiction, because you said, I'm happy to know that I'm out of here.
Yeah.
If you're out of here, it's not fine.
Exactly, that's just a way of speaking.
Yeah. Nirvana was saying a whole lot better than it was me who was going there.
Exactly.
Rather than just.
That's right, yeah. So that misses the point. I'm stopping all this going. It's a very good point. Thank you for saying that.
Is it, and is this sort of bitter
when
you teach meditation,
that
little by little,
like,
kind of our mind
should
become much better?
Yeah, that's right. That's why the Buddha said a gradual training. Because usually I just saw this a couple of days ago. When the Buddha gave his teaching, he gave a gradual discourse, and first of all he taught about the benefits of precepts and benefits of going to heaven, and then he sort of the benefits of renunciation, and then and the benefits of heaven, and then he would hit them with the Four Noble Truths. He would never do the Four Noble Truths straight away. The gradual discourse, I got the order wrong there, but it was something like that. It basically sucked you in. And then when you're ready, because beautiful teachings inspired and hinted without, bang, is what you didn't want to hear. But well, you know, my mum used to give me, pour the medicine, take some sugar or something, and then you take the medicine. The economy. I say, John, question.
I don't know, you can say that the self is the fear the next week you tell me.
Well, even defilements don't have fear. It's like the fear is part of the process. It's basically you look upon it like a dog being killed. Doesn't want to sort of die. And this may say that the farmer's stubborn with desire, the process doesn't want to end. There's almost got a vested interest in this continuation. And you're challenging it to recall. When I was a kid watching horror movies, yeah, sure, people would be killed, and that was scary. When I was a kid, the scariest scene in a movie was like the devil coming to steal your soul. You. And that was the most scariest scene. Sometimes we have these Christian metaphors of selling your soul to the devil. Now I can tell you these days, if the devil came along and said, Adam, were you selling my soul? I said, yeah, I mean, you've got to do a bit more work on the retreat centre. Maybe $10,000 and it's yours. And they'll say, yeah, I'll take that. I'll take the 10,000. The devil just get nothing. I wouldn't do that because that would be sort of cheating the devil. There's no one in here. But when I was young, that was the scariest thing to do, to lose your soul. Well, you know there's nothing in there, so I have to be afraid of it. Yeah, go on. Yeah, the outcome is it. Yeah. That's right, you want to. Absolutely. Simplicity. Exactly, yeah. This is one of the problems when you do become a monk or a nun, you become a nobody. Especially the first few years at the end of the line. No one talks to you. They just look at the abbot or the second monk. You're not special anymore. You just have to clean the toilets. You're absolutely nobody. And for many people that's such a difficult thing. But after many years of being a nobody, the more you disappear, the more famous you become. It's a weird thing. That's why Eckhart Tolle is a famous monk, but he was a man. So this is actually what happens, that to be, you want to do something, you want to exist. That's why a lot of times with some young monks, they're upatakiing, you're having a discussion, they have to say something. Why do you have to sort of interrupt and say something? You may be in the kitchen having a conversation, why do you interrupt? It doesn't matter right or wrong, it's all rubbish anyway, you know, in the kitchen. But why do you have to interrupt? Because you want to be somebody. You know, otherwise you just disappear, you're not there anymore. And every now and again you get some really good monks. And sometimes you don't even know they're here. They're just wafting into the kitchen, or to the dining cell, they have their meal and they'll just waft out again. They don't say anything to you. They don't do anything. They're just almost invisible. They're the ones who disappear. For those of you who want to go to Sangha, give up hope, all ye who want to hear. Go on. That was actually written on the walls of the hell room in Dante's Inferno. An ancient Christian text, yeah?
I don't know if it's important or not, if it's worth yeah. asking, but something about the description of an arahant or something better being, something like that, I'm not sure.
I destroyed the petal of being.
Is that important to understand?
Oh yeah, that's the false idea to know. I tell you, if you be something, that ties you down. Mm-hmm. When you want to be something, you can't be free. You know, sometimes you want to sort of go to university and be a doctor, or sort of be a scientist, or sort of be a mother. When you want to be something, that really ties you down.
The word fetter, the word fetter is something.
It's like a ball and chain.
Or like the
ties you down.
And
yeah.
Just, in terms of, so ideally, it's really good to live a monastic life to just.
Depends what monastery.
Yeah.
There's some monasteries that you become a famous monk, famous abbot, give lots of talks.
If we can't find a monastery, where we can
disappear.
And we have to live to lay back until we find a good monastery.
Yeah.
I feel like where there's more freedom to control and will, and then it's easy to
get caught up in all this will of mind, because sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's really easy to like just to continue meditating and
you just continue meditating. And then you realize if you want to get to deep meditation, you can't control it. When you try to control it, it all goes wrong. And you let go, make peace, and just completely disappear. Then you get these amazing meditations. And if any of you have had a deep meditation, you know in those deep meditations, the deeper it is, the less you're left. It's you getting away to go deeper in meditation. Just won't let yourself go and disappear. That's what's called viraga, the fading away in the sense of the self with its will. Fade away more and more, you just get more peaceful.
What about awareness?
Awareness reaches its peak in the false dharma and then it disappears. Even sati is not being a mind of the self. It's impermanent, even sati, it's dukkha. That's called stopping talking. Your mindfulness. Remember, it's got to go stage by stage, so don't give the mindfulness up too early. Don't get it to its peak and then let it fade away.
To develop that level of confidence, should one sort of develop what happiness in the airport path?
Yeah, that's good. Indulge in the airport path, make much of it, delight in it, and then all the delight finishes.
But sometimes in one view, they can be like the fear of anything happening.
Absolutely, yeah. It's amazing how many people feel. That's the purest one idea. If you enjoy it, it must be bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
Now I feel okay.
Actually, the Supa and Asupa, do they somewhere disappear in the
past? Oh, of course they do. It's no beautiful, it's no, not beautiful, it's just things we add really onto things. So after a while, there's a whole lot of disappears. I'm going to go back to the appendix. Now I'm going to turn over to the appendix again. Yeah, because you can see what's going on here. So if the unabstracted worldling, because they've got wrong view, that's the reason they haven't fully understood it, then their whole perception is wrong. They perceive earth as earth, but it's not right. They perceive it as something that it isn't. And so because their view is wrong, their perception is wrong, then their conception just goes really stupid. They can see that money is mine. It's my bank account. It's my house. It's my clothes. Or sometimes I'm contained in this thing, or I'm apart from this thing, or this thing is mine. You don't know anything, and therefore you're delighted in what's yours. So the whole thing is from view, perception, conception, and that also creates delight. The stream winner, you've got right view. You've seen at least once, just totally, there is no self. There's nothing which is really there. You've understood dependent resignation, just a process. If I understand these things which you thought were happy are just a suffering, then the cessation is the ultimate happiness. While other people think you're suffering. And because of that, you can, the view is correct, but you still haven't undone the process. Sometimes I explain this as sometimes people understand that smoking is bad for your health. You know it's bad for you, you understood that, you've got no doubt about it, but you can't stop yet. It's like a habit which has been ingrained in you for so many years. And understanding what the idea is of habits. For the stream winner, yeah, they know these things aren't, that sex isn't sort of fun, that these things aren't me, not mine, not a self. But the habit is so strong, it takes a while for your new understanding to percolate through and change the whole way you conceive. Sometimes that takes 7 lifetimes. So you've got your view correct. So view is okay, but the perception of thought, they're not in line yet with your right view. It takes a while. Therefore the Buddha said, train yourself. Even though you don't actually know, please don't think in terms of this is me, I'm in this, I'm apart from this, or this is mine. Train yourself not to think like that. so that you won't delight in these things. It's not possible not to delight in these things unless you've seen oneself. That's why when you say to yourself, oh, I mustn't delight in the food, I mustn't delight in seeing beautiful women, beautiful boys, I must not delight in movies, you can't do that. You will delight in these things until you've seen non-self. The right view comes first. Those three fetters have to be abandoned by the spring winner, especially the self-view. And then karma chanda vyapada will overcome. Then delight and all will overcome. But you have to overcome self-view first of all.
Again, is delight adding some sense of self-connection, isn't it?
Yeah, what you delight in, that's who you sometimes you become. That's you.
So is it really going back to like a conceptual response?
Conceptual response, yes. It's part of the conceptual framework. I think the things I delight in. I think of fish and chips and mushy peas. I think of a walk in the springtime in Paris. I think of listening to Jimi Hendrix. I think of all these things I delight in. How many times you think in things you hate? Or you don't delight in? Except when you delight in hating. People do that, you know, they're delighted, so getting angry.
Yeah.
You find fault.
Yes, and you know, like, as the drop is like the natural arising of joy.
Yeah.
But it sounds that it has a different quality to delighting.
Yeah.
How is that? Because they are probably ones that experience a lot of bliss.
They do, yeah. This is actually delight. It these perceptions which come from a sense of self. And ownership. So you can delight in these things. Remember, I've used to explain this as you delight in letting go, which is the opposite of delight in ownership. You delight in disappearing, which is the opposite of delight in self, in sense of self.
So if one feels like a gratitude that there's a part out of suffering,
yeah,
when is that feeling?
That's new on me, so that's unworldly happiness.
Because one doesn't really, one can't really say one possesses such a power because it's not known at all.
If you try and possess it, the delight disappears. Then if you try and possess the nimitta, you try and possess the meditation, and the whole thing falls apart. You can't possess your meditation, it has to be letting go. Sometimes that's where we make the mistake of getting peaceful and they grab onto it. And they try and own their nimitta, or own their just their joy. At last I can meditate. Stupid.
So again, it seems as though it's okay to cultivate that happiness in wholesome dharmas.
Cultivating wholesome dharmas, if it starts to disappear, means you're time to own it. So when it goes, it goes. I wonder.
Because it seems like there has to be that aspect of happiness to fuel the
happiness is a very enormous and important part of the path. Again, it's not the craving for truth. People think they want to know the truth. But when it gets down to it, the chips are down, no, it's quite to be comfortable rather than seeing the truth. But it's a delight and joy. That's just too nice. What the hell? I'm going for it. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. So they have no delight in food anymore, so how would they choose their food? Or could they say, oh, I really like it, and they speak the truth?
Yeah, they would probably say what is useful for their body, or useful for other people. So there'd be a field of merit.
And a comment, I suppose.
Yeah, sure.
It was just about what I was talking about earlier. Conceive, concept, and construct. Like a conception is a construction.
Yeah, correct.
And a perception
is a construction.
Is it a conception?
Yeah, it is, in a sense. But here we're talking about perception being like the primary cognitive process. Where you're seeing something.
On the construct.
Well, not really, because the view comes before that. Conception is no sort of first here. But, you know, usually most people think the perception is first, the bare perception, the bricks by which your house is built, you perceive. And the thoughts is actually building the house. And the views is the house which you live in. And then that makes the brick, makes perception. This is the link which a lot of people don't see, the view. Psychologists know this. The view actually bends your perception. And so you say, first of all, what you think is the first thing which comes into your mind has already been bent, twisted. So in fact, that's even your birth perceptions.
So what I was going to get to then is everything is basically a construct, and the only thing you can trust is the birth mind.
The birth mind, and should deconstruct it.
Is that the same as their awareness?
No, it's in a sense, it's awareness which is bare of the hindrances for a long period of time.
Yeah. So really, like just as a conversational phrase, the direct knowing is probably the only, if we're talking about direct knowing, is the only thing you can really trust.
Yeah, but it's good to say what direct knowing means. Mm-hmm. It means like when the hindrances are totally absent. And you're seeing things as they truly are, not as you imagine them to be, not as you want them to be, not as filtering out parts of them you don't like.
So turn on their awareness, is that already loaded?
Loaded, yeah. It's loaded because its use these days is just thinking of not thinking, just knowing without the thought coming afterwards. So that sometimes that was used in Zen, being barely aware. But it never made any mention of the hindrances and the fact that what comes to your awareness as bare perception has already been twisted.
I was drawing a distinction between bare awareness and bare perception because I think perception is already, it's already warped.
That's right. But even the difference between awareness and perception in the English language is a very difficult one to distinguish.
And consciousness, bare consciousness, is that a
perception? Given that consciousness, in a way that it's used in Buddhism, the six types of consciousness, consciousness is almost the screen on which these other things are played out.
So really, direct knowing is
direct understanding, yeah. Direct means there's nothing in between you and that object, no hindrances messing around. And ask one who directly knows these things, because they have understood that delight is the root of suffering. Root of suffering, yeah, that's just the second noble truth. And that with being as condition, there is birth. That's bhava-paccaya jati. Yeah, it's bhava-paccaya jati, that stage of the dependent origination. The cause for new birth.
And being is a condition of?
Being is that craving to be.
That's the
being, I am. This is mine. I'm in this, I'm not that, it's that type of being.
And then it's the destruction of craving.
Craving is the destruction of being. They disappear. Therefore, there's no more birth. When you're there, you'll be reborn. When you disappear, nothing to be reborn in. That's what the Blessed One said, but those monks were not delighting the Blessed One's works. However, there was a happy ending. Because sometime later, the Buddha taught the same monks, according to the commentaries, another sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya at the Gotamaka Shrine. And when they taught the second sutra, all those monks got fully in mind. They got the point. Now what's really weird is actually this second sutra, so I'm going to read it out now. So who knows? Hopefully you didn't understand that first sutra. And now when I read this one out, you too will become fully in mind. Are you ready? At the Gotamaka shrine, this is Anguttara Nikaya in the threes, number 123. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at the Gotamaka shrine near Vaisali. There the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, and this is supposed to be the same monks. On the basis of direct knowledge I teach the Dhamma, O monks, not without direct knowledge. On good grounds I teach the Dhamma, not without good grounds. Convincingly I teach the Dhamma, not unconvincingly. Therefore, monks, my advice should be followed and my instructions accepted. This, monks, is sufficient for your satisfaction, sufficient for your gladness, sufficient for your joy. Fully enlightened is the Blessed One. Well proclaimed is the Blessed One's Dhamma. Well conducted is the Sangha. Thus spoke the Blessed One. Gladdened, those monks approved the Blessed One's words. While his discourse was being spoken, the thousandfold world system shook. That was it. That's amazing. Just, that's not what you expect. You expect the Buddha to explain it more deeply or do something. The Buddha said was actually to trust what he just said there. They had heard it, they'd remembered it, they didn't understand it because they were too proud to even consider it could be true. And now the Buddha sort of told them it was true. Think of it. It was obviously a very, very powerful teaching. And he said that on good grounds, convincingly, therefore you should follow my instructions. This mark is sufficient for your satisfaction, your gladness and your joy. As you were saying earlier, it's important for the path. So through that joy and gladness, hindrances can be overcome, and you can see what the Buddha was saying in that discourse. According to the commentary, they did understand, became enlightened, which is why the world system shook. That is a deep teaching. It's at the beginning because it has to do with the essence of non-self, and also just delusion and how it works. Why, or rather, what is delusion? And why are we deluded? And how can that delusion end? It's classic, standard teachings of the Buddha. Five hindrances are what keeps delusion going. It's their food, their nutriment. Take off the five hindrances and delusion is weakened and weakened and weakened until the values kill off. And then you see this whole system of cognition, the way your mind works. Then why didn't I see that? I know why, because I couldn't do anything else. It was just the whole process. Self-justifying. Now you've seen it, the whole process is unraveled. And you know that after a while, it can't be that long. Once the right view is straightened, perception and thought don't have to be straightened. It's only a matter of time. The whole process is mortally wounded. 7 lifetimes. And it's the end. And Mula Pariyaya, the root of all things, the source. If anyone say, where did we come from? Stupidity. I was born in stupidity. I live in stupidity. That's my root, that's my cause. So if any Christian asks you who created the world, stupidity did. And that is a very good Buddhist answer. Doesn't satisfy. I think you're crazy, but that's true. Okay, I think that's enough. So, have you got another question? Answer again. Tease it. Okay.
It's the words of another, isn't it, that helps to change that thing?
Yeah. It helps to change it because that's a seed, which is part of you. One day you blast away all those images and delusion. Isn't
that? I feel really sure that any of the five elements that you have started knowledge, because some people they think like virtual life.
That's right. Number one, it's very clear to know when the hindrances have gone if you just come out of the jhanas. So the jhanas are very easy to understand. five senses gone. And one can't hear, can't see, can't feel the body, and you drift out of this car. So if you're getting done, big experience, you know what's done. So afterwards, yeah, that's what's done. If you haven't got it done yet, then you don't know what the five senses are when they disappear. So that's why we have the Eightfold Path, which culminates in the jhanas. Keep practicing, practicing. Jhanas comes along. And then you know what it's like without hindrances. You know what you see after the hindrances. You know that that's too hard. Just like, you know, you climbed up the mountain, you can see it. Just like the mist is gone. Sometimes I can't find my glasses, so I can't read. And I put my glasses on, I can read now. So without my glasses, it's like hindrances on the eyes. Andy, you have a question?
What the Buddha is not.
What the Buddha is not?
Yeah.
The Buddha is not a person, not a being. The Buddha is not you, not me. Buddha's not anything. The Buddha's not nothing. Just a process. Yeah, it's not what? Yeah, whatever. Yeah?
One of the talks, you said about the whole process of life, you said it's not one of those boxes that you spend the old
time. Oh, yeah.
You press the button on the hand, and then it turns itself off. And it all just seems so utterly pointless.
Exactly, isn't it wonderful? Well, you're here. You started it out, so you've got to stop it.
Before
that, I mean, where you started, I don't know. Don't blame me, it's your fault.
The mind is what we're all people.
You're all here, yeah. We really stuffed up, didn't we?
Yeah. But the mind must have. Where's the mind?
Stupidity.
Tell
you that. The thing is, the first beginning of things is very difficult to see, but this cycle, you see that cycle which I had, view, perception, thought, you can see it going around, but you can't see where it started. It's all chicken and egg thing.
It's always been there.
Yeah, for such a long time. I like the simile which I've given of like, the meteor, this lump of rock travelling around our solar system for hundreds of thousands of millions of, no, it can't be that long, for tens of thousands of millions of years. Lump of rock, that's a long time, 1,000 million years. Round and round. And just, it just happens, its orbit just happens to meet the Earth. And it enters our atmosphere and it blazes in this fiery comet, fiery meteor trail. You see like the shooting star. It burns so brightly, so beautiful and brilliant. And that's it. It's finished forever. No more travelling around the universe. That's like the Arahant. The beautiful shooting star. The death. The end. The lump of rock which has been travelling around. Around. I like that scene. That's a nice one. But the other thing, if you don't know, if anyone ever finds one of these things, I don't mind donating one and putting it in the hall somewhere. That was these, when I was a young monk in Thailand, some people came from the United States and they say one of these coffee shop things which was quite popular for a while was a machine, a box. It's just an ordinary box, a metal box, made about so high, they said. You just had one little switch on the outside. And you put it on your coffee table, and people would ask you, what is it? So you throw the switch and see what it does. So you throw the switch, and then it has some batteries inside, and you hear these motors starting up and these cogwheels going, and then this flap would lift from the side. And then this mechanical arm would come out this hole in the side, go around to the front, switch itself off and then go back inside again. It was a machine whose whole purpose was to switch itself off. They were brilliant similes for Nirvana. That's what you are. Your whole purpose in life is to switch yourself off. Beautifully nihilistic, I love it. Come on.
Is it okay to understand it as what has to be subject to the cessation?
Oh yes, that's actually that's important, because the opposite of cessation of suffering, when it starts to disappear, is the happiness which takes you through.
You know, that's true. Okay, I just have to, because I think it'll help. It's very useful.
Yes.
You mentioned during the retreat, I think actually you gave this metaphor of when you were in Cambridge and it was very misty, you couldn't see anything, and you were walking, and then so what led you out is like slowly, slowly just.
Yeah, that's just got me. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that was actually getting lost in the mountains in Scotland.
Okay, that was very useful.
Yeah, yes, sorry. Because you didn't know which way to go. And I almost fell over a cliff, and it was a big cliff. I mean, that was maybe 100 metres down. It was really scary. Totally lost. Running around this mountain. And just, after a while, what can I do to get out of this mess? And I just found a stream. Streams go down. If you follow that stream, eventually it's going to take you down. So I couldn't see sort of where to go. But I knew that if I followed that stream, I was getting closer to my destination. I couldn't see the destination, but I could see the next step. That's all I needed to do. So you can see that this makes you more peaceful. Feels more free. Feels more released. So take that step. That must lead you down to underneath the mist. But you can't do any barbers. But you can see this is going closer. That's all we need to do. Okay. That's why I left that teaching to the end, because it's one of the most beautiful ones. Very deep. Very challenging. It's meant to be challenging. So, on these teachings, hopefully I'm not telling you what you already know. I'm not telling you what you like to know. I'm telling you what the Buddha says.